Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. The show has been on the air for some 4 years, and I've been thinking about all the important issues that we've pretty much ignored all that time. One of these is the failed war on drugs. But a lot has been happening lately on the drug war front. Connecticut, which is my current place of exile, Connecticut is on the verge of legalizing medical marijuana. By early May, both the State House and Senate passed a bill to legalize medical marijuana, and the governor has announced that he will sign it into law. To put this in context for our out-of-state listeners, Connecticut is a stodgy, uptight, super-establishment, chamber of commerce kind of state. Its main industries are insurance and military hardware, just to let you know what we're up against. But Connecticut has recently established gay marriage, it's just abolished capital punishment, and now it looks like, at long last, we are about to just say no to at least one small part of the ruinous, failed, and horribly expensive drug war this country has been conducting for at least the past 40 years. What it is ain't exactly clear, but something's happening here. The other thing that caught my attention is a new documentary film by Eugene Jarecki on the very subject. It's called The House I Live In. It's not yet available to the public, but it did just win the Sundance Film Festival's Grand Jury Prize. Jarecki's the guy who, in 2005, made the film Why We Fight, about the military-industrial complex. We adapted parts of that film to radio and aired them in December 2010. Why We Fight won the same award at Sundance that his new film on the drug war did. Again, the new one is called The House I Live In, and we'll soon hear Jarecki talk about what he learned while making it. For well over a century, the United States has been criminalizing some drugs but not others, and using the drug laws to imprison members of first one minority group and then another. The Chinese, then the Mexicans, then the blacks. The modern phase of the drug war began in 1971 with the War on Drugs, launched by President Richard M. Nixon. Black people were heavily targeted, and remain so. But as Jarecki sees it, the drug war is shifting, evolving from a means of racial control into a means of class control. The fastest growing demographic of drug prisoners is now poor whites. In April, Eugene Jarecki had a great talk with Michael Slate on The Michael Slate Show. That's a weekly radio program on KPFA Los Angeles. We'll hear some parts of that talk today. Since 1971, Jarecki tells us, the United States has spent $1 trillion on its war on drugs. It has produced 44 million arrests. The war has totally failed to reduce the supply of drugs or to reduce use. It has done tremendous harm to millions of individuals and their families and their communities, and any good it has done is sure hard to see. So why do we keep at it? Why don't we either scrap it or else try a radically different approach? I have my own theories, but let's hear Jarecki's. Here, conversing with Michael Slate, is filmmaker Eugene Jarecki.
You know, if you watch a system like ours operate in an insane space, I mean, the war on drugs has cost $1 trillion at this point. It's our longest war, 40 years, 44 million arrests. It has not reduced the supply of drugs, has not reduced the use of drugs, the sale of drugs, the purity of drugs, the age of the people who are willing to sell them. It has reduced younger and younger people all the time. It's failed in every respect that it promised when it was started. And so you have to ask yourself, how can something so failing, so grotesque and misguided continue? And I wanted to understand what drives this system. And there are really two answers to what drive it. One is it comes out of a long history in this country. Drug laws date way back, and I'll talk about that in a moment. We've seen the evolution of drug laws since the 1800s in America, and so they have deep roots. The other side, of course, is the prison industrial system, the incarceration industry that has emerged, which gives great bureaucratic thrust to this, makes it very hard, even if you recognize that it's totally failed. It's a very hard ship to turn around. It's a huge tanker. But let's go back to the history. The history is that, you know, the first drug laws we saw were in the 1800s when we passed laws against opium. Now, the interesting thing about those laws is they targeted the Chinese. The users of opium in America, the majority of opium users in America were white. I mean, the majority of people were white, but by far the majority of opium users were white. And they were middle-class women, white women in the South, usually. And opium was a drug of choice, and people tolerated it and was very accepted. If somebody was abusing it, going too far, it was seen like they had a health concern. But suddenly, overnight, we passed opium laws. But they weren't passed all over the country. They were only passed in California. And it wasn't just that they were only passed in California. It was only illegal in California to use opium in a particular way, namely to smoke it, which was the one thing that white Americans didn't do. They chewed it. They used it in a whole bunch of other what are called delivery systems, delivery mechanisms. But the smoking of opium, that was a Chinese activity. Now, no coincidence. Chinese were at that point, and I saw the newspaper headlines from that time, they were at that point being perceived as a threat to American jobs. All these incoming Chinese laborers coming to work on railroads, and they were seen as a threat to jobs. And so local politicians out there said, well, we can't put these people in jail because they're Chinese, but we can put them away if we create some behavioral activity common to the Chinese, and we criminalize that. So then you saw the first laws about opium, and that didn't stop there. The next laws we saw criminalized cocaine use, even though cocaine use was common among white Americans. Thomas Edison basically said he couldn't have invented the light bulb without it and lived on it. I think Thomas Edison, I was told, actually had an IV drip of cocaine at one time in his life that he was living on. So don't try that at home. But this was a very common drug in America, loved by the middle and upper classes. But all of a sudden, it becomes associated. I start reading in the paper in the early part of the 20th century, the association between cocaine use and blacks, particularly black men. You'll see headlines that say, drug-crazed Negroes terrorize southern town. Negro cocaine fiends do this terrible thing or another, the insinuation being, put these guys on this drug and they'll come after your wife, they'll come after your daughter. They were portrayed as a great threat to white America. One headline I saw said it made them, if the black man would take cocaine, he would become not susceptible to bullets. Well, they proved very susceptible to bullets, and they were incarcerated and killed at that time in the violence that emerged around the prosecution of cocaine activities that time. And again, it just continued. Mexicans were next with the conversion of hemp into marijuana as a term. So we stopped calling it hemp. We start calling it marijuana, which, of course, brings that sort of Mexican overtone to it. And it was known as a Mexican drug, and it was used to slow the tide of Mexican labor. So this long history, this deep history, brings us to, and this has happened over and over, brings us to the present. I'll tell you something fascinating that actually just dawned on me quite recently as I was finishing up the film. Crack cocaine. We commonly think of crack cocaine as a black drug. The public has been taught to think that. Mm-hmm. One thing your listeners should know, because I didn't know it, it's shocking, is that black Americans don't use cocaine any more than white Americans. Black Americans represent 13% of the country. They are 13% of the crack users. Huh. That means the remaining 87% of the crack users are white and brown. And it actually turns out that the majority of crack users in the United States of America are white. So for starters, what a warped reality we've lived in. Okay? But let's go back to the days where crack was, at its very inception, seen and perhaps with some legitimacy at that time as a black drug. Okay. Why? Because it's a poor drug. It's much cheaper than powder. Okay. So now we have at that time blacks are being targeted by crack cocaine laws. And I don't know if your listeners know this, but crack has been historically punished 100 times as severely as powder. That's insane because they're made of the same chemical. But I spoke to a couple of judges about this, and this has been a point of huge contention among judges and medical professionals and others who have tried to advise Congress that the 100-to-1 crack powder disparity is not based in science, woefully misguided, and morally wrong. I mean, it's unfair. You're punishing if you go down the street and you've got 5 grams of crack cocaine, you're going to get 5 years. If I go down the street and I'm carrying powder, I need 500 grams of powder to get the same penalty. 500 grams of powder is in the many, many thousands of dollars. 5 grams of crack is nothing. It's a poor person's drug. And so at the end of the day, you have this grotesque disparity where the poor person is getting punished 100 times what the comfortable person is for a product that's worth a fraction. As an economic crime, it doesn't even compare. So this is so out of whack. And I said to a judge, well, how can you justify this? And he said, well, you should know that this year it's being brought down to 18 to 1. I said, that was mighty wide of them. Why did they decide to go down to 18 to 1? Why not 1 to 1? He said, well, everything has to happen in steps. And by the way, he said, you know, you say they're the same, but they're not exactly the same. I said, okay, well, what I'd learned was that crack, maybe I'm wrong, but I'd learned from scientists and medical professionals that crack is powder plus baking soda and water. So in other words, it's an adulterated form of powder cocaine. Powder is the purer one, right? Yes, that's true, he said. But the reason we punish crack more severely is the delivery mechanism, that it's smoked, not ingested by snorting it or whatever. Okay, well, reasonable people can disagree about whether the fact that it hits your bloodstream faster or whatever else should make it more punishable or not. I think most people would think that sounds Looney Tunes. Mm-hmm. But okay, take it on face value for the moment. Well, isn't it interesting? Because that's the same exact thing they did with opium. They narrowed down not to the drug is illegal, but rather a specific form of taking the drug is going to be more illegal than another form. Smoking opium will be judged to be a criminal offense in California, but not using opium in some other way. And as it turns out, for those in the country who use powder cocaine, who find themselves nowhere near as susceptible to the law as those who use crack, once again, a delivery system has been singled out as the reason we should have a draconian set of laws. And so we see these patterns unfold and repeat in a way that I find haunting, and the film tries to really shed light on that. To be blunt, Nixon deserves a lot of credit for his activity around the start of the war on drugs, because even though he declared a war on drugs and introduced the worst kind of warlike rhetoric into our vocabulary in dealing with drugs, one of the things the movie goes into is the private truth about Nixon is that he knew very well that treatment worked better than law enforcement. And he was spending two-thirds of his drug budget on treatment rather than the one-third that was being spent on law enforcement. If you told somebody that today, it makes him a far-left progressive in terms of how to deal with the drug war, to compare him to Clinton or to Reagan or to Obama. I mean, he's on a whole other level of looking at it, treatment versus punishment. The worst you can say about Nixon, however, is that that shows you he knew better. When he went back out on the campaign trail in 1972 and went right back to the same tough-on-crime rhetoric that had gotten him elected in 68, then you see the true colors of someone willing to play with fear-mongering to get elected. And by so doing, and by being successful in 72, his tough-on-crime rhetoric in 72 was tremendously effective, even though he privately knew what he was doing was treatment-oriented. It's a heinous thing, but bear in mind, nothing Nixon did comes close to what Reagan and Clinton did. Mm-hmm. Nothing. Yeah. So now you have Reagan and Clinton, the two standard bearers for the right and the left in the next 20 years, in terms of Washington, yeah. Right and left. In the Washington's right and left, supposed. I'm holding up quotes with my fingers. You guys can't see me. But those are the guys who ratchet the thing out of all compass. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not Nixon's apologist. Nixon created the war on drugs, and I'm making a film about the tragedy of the war on drugs. So I'm laying a huge amount at his doorstep. But my criticism of him is, if anything, it's a bit more textured, because it actually tells you that he was willing to be so deceitful as to hide the evidence of his own success at drug treatment. And so that's even worse. Mm-hmm. In a weird way, that's even worse. But what I also don't want to do is simplify the historical record, because understanding that in Nixon, strangely, lies an example of the power of treatment sends a tremendously helpful signal to people who may not be inclined to think that way. And one way that I think one has to go about thinking about reform of the drug war is to find a sensible balancing act between public health approaches to this and criminal justice approaches.
On New World Notes, we heard filmmaker Eugene Jarecki talking about the long history and the highly selective use of anti-drug laws in the U.S., bringing us up to the time of the old Cold Warrior and Drug Warrior, President Richard M. Nixon, in the 1970s. Surprisingly, Nixon's anti-drug policies were much more enlightened than those of every president since, including Obama. Now Jarecki takes us up to the present. He says that drug enforcement has always been about race, but now it seems more and more about the class war.
But you look at just the statistics across the board, from 1970 until now, the massive leap in the prison population in the U.S. to what you say in your film. It's like the biggest prison, it's the biggest prison house in the world.
Yeah.
And the vast majority of those people are black.
Well, what we saw over several decades was a ridiculous disproportion in the number of black people being put away. For example, I said earlier how 13% of the country is African-American, 13% of crack users are African-American. So now what you have, when you then look at it as in the federal system, 90% of those processed for crack cocaine charges are black. 13% of crack users are black, but 90% of those in court are black. So that's insane. And that tells you a great deal about racial profiling, tells you a great deal about the profiling in the law, the way that not being able to get a lawyer if you're poor, all those things. But one of the things that has happened, and this is sort of the new development that my film began to follow as well, is that as white people are becoming poorer and poorer in this country, the drug war is democratizing. I would argue it's one of our most democratic institutions because increasingly the groups that are that have the higher incarceration growth rates are white, Latino women. Black Americans are not actually growing. They're still robust because we always find a way to pick on black people in this country, but there's no question that that group is holding steady while other groups are growing, and that is in direct relation to the kind of poverty that produces two things. Poverty produces despair and the desire to self-medicate or have an escape. If you sit around in a neighborhood full of violence with no opportunity and no chance to get out, your odds of using an illicit substance to sustain yourself amid those furies goes up. But at the same time, if you lock people out of the mainstream economy, you massively increase the odds that they're going to involve themselves in underground economies. And as David Simon, the creator of The Wire, who's in the film, says, you know, we've seen this with every immigrant group in the history of the country. Every time they come here, they're locked out of the main engines of economic growth, and they turn to underground economies, and then we police them, and the cycle begins. And black Americans have this just the same as other immigrant groups. As you know, black Americans very often are seen as an immigrant group themselves, having moved to northern urban centers, having been rural inhabitants before that. If someone were to ask me today, you know, what is the fabric of my film in terms of these questions about race and class? My film moves from race to class. First hour or something of my film explores pretty deeply the contemporary workings and the history of the drug war's harrowing impact on black Americans, on black American males, the disruption of the black American family, the orphaning of black children to incarcerated parents. One of the primary determinants in whether a child will go to jail in his or her lifetime is whether they have a parent in jail. We know that to be true, and we see these generations and generations of black Americans being put into that cycle of never-ending despair in many ways. The film studies that. It takes a turn at a certain point because I follow a character named Carl Hart, who's a black professor at Columbia, who had grown up in the streets of Miami, a dealer himself, and then ultimately found his way to the Air Force and found his way to a professorship at Columbia where he studies really the effects of drugs on the brain. He's very interested in the brain, and that's his area of expertise. But he's very aware of what happened with crack in the 80s when he was growing up. He's very aware of how often drug laws are based not on science but on propaganda and public policy goals, nefarious ones often. And so he turned his attention in recent months and years to meth, and the way in which meth users, who are usually white, sort of trailer park, again in quotes, Americans as they're seen, or gay Americans as often are associated with meth in the mainstream media, how these groups are being vilified all over again, just like black crack users were. Speeches by people like Hillary Clinton warning Americans of how meth users are out there trying to seduce your children into using meth, intercut with images that suggest the association between meth and the risk of AIDS. This kind of propaganda is returning with a vengeance, taking the struggle of a handful of people, of a population of people in this country, which is to say white meth users, and turning it into the fabric of a fear-mongering campaign all over again like we've seen before. When I watched Carl Hart, this magnificent, dreadlocked Columbia professor, turning his attention as a black American to the defense of white Americans under the threat of fear-mongering propaganda about their meth use, I found it so inspiring that my film followed him there. And that means that the film ultimately makes the point, I think, or studies the idea that what began in a ragtag bunch of racist laws over time, drug laws that were meant to target, whether it was Chinese, Mexican, black, whomever they targeted over time, Native, that over time what it has evolved into is something that is more about class. And that at this point, as David Simon says in the film, you know, there's just a bottom 15% of the country that the country sort of doesn't really think it needs. And so first it tries to lock these people up and kind of get them out of the way. Then they figured out they could make money off of doing that. So it becomes a whole prison industrial system built on mass incarceration. And at a certain point, Simon says, why don't we just be honest with ourselves and just say, let's kill the poor. Because if we kill the poor, it'll make it much easier for the rest of us. And he's being cynical, of course, and facetious, but he's alluding to something very real, which is that the drug war, as it became an industry, see, what Nixon did when he made it a war was he imbued it with all the problems that wars have. And we all know the problems that we're seeing in the ongoing wars we have, which is in large part that industrial interests, a vast network of industrial interests, large and small, come to rely upon the war. I would argue our system is addicted to the drug war far more than any addictions within the drugs that are being fought against. This country is hooked on the drug war in many ways at the community level, because if you go to a prison, well, who's making the food? Who's serving? Who's providing the laundry service, the phone service, the heat, the air conditioning? Who's fixing the systems, the light, all this stuff? So all of that is huge amounts of industrial systems that come to rely upon the perpetuation of this. And so as I start to look at it and I look at how this has moved from race to class, well, I went to a prison industrial trade show during the course of the film to film there. And that's a macabre experience because, you know, what at another trade show might be toilet plungers or shower curtain rods or something they'd be selling. Here there's a lady selling you a restraint chair that can restrain a prisoner better than another chair. Here's a faster, better, stronger stun gun. Over there's a new system for electric fencing. Here's a new system. But then there are even weird ones. You know, then there's some real normal ones. Like, here's a food service company. Here's this. And they're telling you all about how cheaply they can basically throw barely edible fodder at the, like feed, basically. And you go around. And when you look at this, and then I saw one organization, it was a legal company, selling legal services to prisons. And I said, oh, that's very interesting. What kind of legal services? Thinking, I don't know, they're giving their inmates lawyers or something. No, they said, we provide legal services to prisons to help them block the efforts of their inmates to appeal. Now, it was all I could do, because I'm supposed to be there just kind of absorbing information. It was all I could do to say, so the service you provide is to block the due process privileges of an American citizen? That's what you're trying to do, is undermine due process? That's the company. Where's the logo around here? You know, what does that look like? So it's like a constitution with that Ghostbusters signal over it, you know? Sign over it. So all that being said, the reason the film moves from race to class is that the drug war's hunger, its appetite, is moving toward class. Because if I were sitting around and I ran, now there is no conspiracy of greedy, grumpy old Dick Cheney's who sit around a table in this. It's far more innocent than that in its daily expression. So yes, there is, through the totality of it, there's grave evil. But the individual parts, I met incredibly well-meaning, likable, and not just like, oh, shucks, likable, but like really likable, deep people. A lot of them are in my film who carry on and they try to do the best they can with their small part of this thing. And a lot of them even know that the system is wrong. And a lot of them don't like how prisoners are being dealt with. A lot of them don't like, I talk to jailers who hate the fact that they're getting so many prisoners and they think the laws are wrong. But they'll say, I try to do my best once they come in here to give them a skill or to show them a sense of community they never had on the outside there. It's striking how aware a lot of the people I met are. But one of the things you can imagine, if you want to just for sort of storybook sake, if you want to imagine, oh, there's a round table conspiracy that hatches this kind of thing. Well, if there's such a conspiracy in sort of the subtle underworkings of the system, something that's never happened, but it's sort of the idea. Well, that system at some point noticed, well, we run a business here. How can we make our business bigger? Oh, there's more poor white people coming down the pike. Well, why are we limiting our market share to the poor black population? Why not, what do they call it, diversify? Mm-hmm. So it's without being smug about it, because nobody had the conversation I just said, but that conversation is in the air. It's in the drinking water without anyone ever saying it. Mm-hmm. It's much darker. There is the clear recognition that with new challenging economic times for whites, there's a woman in the film who says, it's a growing business. And I said, what do you mean it's a growing business? She goes, well, there's a lot of prisoners in the United States. And you can see she's struggling because she really recognizes, I just referred to human beings as sort of market indicators of a growing business.
Filmmaker Eugene Jarecki. His new documentary, The House I Live In, explores the still ongoing war on drugs. Despite the huge financial costs and the huge social costs, despite the clear failure of this war to reach any of its supposed goals, the war is being prosecuted just as avidly by the Obama administration as it was under both Bushes, Clinton, and Reagan. Ironically, the originator of the modern drug war, Richard Nixon, was in fact the least bad commander of it, devoting two-thirds of his anti-drug budget to treatment, versus almost nothing now. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. Why does the war continue? Jarecki sees two forces at work. First, the ruling elite finds drug laws handy tools to incapacitate dispossessed groups before they can rebel. Secondly, thanks to privatization, we now have a profit-making incarceration industry. Convicting more people for drug offenses means more business and more profit for the Corrections Corporation of America and the like. And you can bet their lobbyists and their money are hard at work promoting incarceration as the best solution to America's drug problem. Jarecki is considering only domestic reasons, but let's not forget how handy the war on drugs rhetoric is for foreign policy. We can arm right-wing dictatorships abroad and train their soldiers and their death squads. The dictatorship will use its military to suppress all attempts by its citizens to bring about democracy and economic reforms. And Americans won't object if our leaders tell us they're arming these thugs to help keep drugs off our streets. The clearest example of this today might be Colombia. And there's yet another topic we ought to get around to one of these days. Many thanks to Michael Slate and The Michael Slate Show for a fine discussion with filmmaker Eugene Jarecki. You'll find more stuff by Slate at his website, redfuture.com. And don't forget newworldnotes.blogspot.com. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Thank you for listening. Illegit am I non-carborundum, and please don't use illegal drugs. It just gives them one more excuse to bust you. As Joe Hill might have said, don't smoke, snort, or inject. Organize. Ciao.